Podcast. I'm Jacob Birch. Eric Steven is with me.
Hello.
We're going to be talking about bullpen woes, hurt players, new players. But first, Eric, I know you want to start, as we have been the last few weeks, with the Cody Bellinger pace update.
Yeah, so you'll note, I'll just get right out to it. He's still on pace for, it would be a Dodger record season, but in a very ridiculous season, but not quite superhuman levels as he has been, but 63 home runs and 171 RBIs as of Monday morning. There's a reason that those numbers are a little bit lower than they were, and we'll get into it, I'm sure.
Yeah, because the rate stats actually haven't changed all that much.
Yeah, he's been like pretty consistent like the whole year. I do in my weekend reviews on the site, I have like a batter of the week, and he's won every week except for the first week, where he did at least. And I know those first 4 days, like we argued about it on the podcast.
I had him winning. He had
every right to win, but Jock Peterson was just a hair better in my opinion. But they were like, it's like 1A, 1B type thing. But this past week, Bellinger was, he was only 5-for-16 with a double. So his 764 OPS was like half of his like season total almost. So, you know, not quite, but he kind of slept a little bit, but then also he got hurt Friday night, and he only had one at bat like over the weekend. Natural first baseman coming up, he's played some outfield obviously, but the concern always is with him going to the outfield is, well, he's more likely to get hurt in the outfield. And we had that a couple years ago in Detroit where he like tweaked his ankle trying to make a catch. But it's just like, you can't prevent baseball players from injuring themselves by what are you going to do? Like wrap them in bubble wrap or something. You just kind of got to play. And if they could play it, they could play it. But Bellinger actually got hurt playing first. He was diving for a ground ball. His right shoulder, separated like out from his socket, and then like immediately like popped back in, but still like, so they were very cautious about it. He didn't start Saturday. And then he pinch hit Sunday, but he struck out on three pitches. So really not much of a presence at all those last 2 days. Don't know exactly when he's going to be back in the lineup, but I would imagine some point soon this week. But yeah, so it's not the best of news for, the Dodgers certainly didn't need that at this point.
Yeah, they mentioned on the broadcast that had it been a night game, he would have started, and had it been maybe August or September, he would have started. So certainly hope to see him start the next game, maybe at first, maybe, take a little breather from the outfield action.
And since they were in San Diego, it's basically like there's no way that game's ever going to be on ESPN, so for a Sunday night game. So, yeah, so he wasn't going to play. But, yeah, they play the Braves tonight. By the time this is out, he might have already played. Who knows? But would imagine he's going to be back in there sooner rather than later.
Not the only Dodger to be dealing with injury woes. And A.J. Pollock's is sounding like, well, it certainly is a lot worse relative to Cody's, but it's sounding like it might be not so good.
Yeah, he got hurt, over a week ago.
Like at Wrigley? Is that right?
Yeah, I think so. And it kind of lingered. It was his elbow. And I guess he had elbow inflammation is what they were saying. And he ended up going on the DL earlier this last week. And then like a few days into that, it was announced that he was going to go in and have surgery. And part of the surgery was like to remove hardware from previous elbow surgeries to give you, we sort of talked about this when AJ Pollock was signed, like how he's been very like injury prone, and he from 2013 to 18, so a 6 year span, he averaged 101 games. He only played 150 games once. So you kind of know what you're getting there. It's not always the same thing. He doesn't necessarily have a chronic issue, although now that he has the elbow thing, he might, But he had surgery in 2016 on his elbow, and that's sort of what they're going in to correct, and partially too to relieve the inflammation he had. So it's a very vague timetable right now.
Hopefully this season is like the all that's been said.
Well, yeah, the only thing Dave Roberts would commit to is like, yeah, we expect him to play again this season, which is like the just the vote of confidence you want to hear.
Backhanded hope.
Yeah, so like it doesn't sound like it's gonna be like short term. It seems like this is gonna be weeks, if not months. So that sort of opens up some possibilities for the Dodgers in terms of like.
Yeah, I think the silver lining is Verdugo. Yeah. This happens every year, right? Where there's this playing time problem where, there's this either younger player or player who's kind of de facto not a starter heating up. How are you going to get more play time? And it's wait a week and we'll figure it out.
Right. And then like Verdugo, he is basically like ran with all the chances he's gotten, and he's like he's hitting very well. He's as of right now 329, 360, 576. He's hitting lefties and righties, so that bodes well for him, like getting playing time. He could play all three outfield positions, and that bodes well for him as well. And he's been playing. Chris Taylor has been starting a lot as well. The Dodgers played a bunch of lefties last week that played into it, but I think Verdugo is probably going to be the biggest benefactor from Pollock being out, but at the same time, they kind of do need like part of the reason they traded Puig and Kemp away, and that left them without a couple of good right-handed bats they had. And part of the reason for Pollock, it helped balance them a little bit and gave them like a true center fielder. Of all the things, Pollock, he was not good. Like he's hitting 223, 287, 330 overall. Not very good. But the one thing he was actually doing well was hitting lefties. He was 10 for 30 against them, 333, 394, 433. So respectable, very productive, like against lefties. So that sort of gives the Dodgers something they need to sort of fill. Dodgers aren't doing like bad against lefties. I know they had a problem like part of the way last year, but like right now they actually have a 108 WRC plus against lefties, which is not bad. It's above average. It's 10th in the majors. So, but compared to against righties, they have a 120 WRC RC plus. So that's fourth. So they're still a good offense, but I think they could be even better. And they're just missing Pollock sort of, bites into that a little bit.
One of the interesting things, you and I during spring training talked a lot about pitcher depth because Dodgers were dealing with a lot of sort of injuries on that half of the team. And the good news for the Dodgers is they had a litany of depth in AAA and in AA, and largely had avoided a position player being hurt. But I was thinking a couple of weeks ago, they really don't have a lot of players at that sort of AAA level that they can kind of call up for a cup of coffee. We'll talk about the one they did for a little bit when we get to questions. Yeah. And it makes sense that the Dodgers then signed a recently designated for assignment Travis d'Arnaud from the Mets.
Yeah, I was going to say too, like we saw this when Russell Martin went down, right? Like for all the like the talk of the Dodgers having great catching depth, and they do, even without Grandal, like Will Smith and K-Bear Ruiz are like, you know, a little bit of ways away. Will Smith's not on the 40-man. So for a short-term thing, they weren't necessarily going to call him up, but I think he's much better than at least offers more potential than Rocky Gale.
And the floor can't be much worse.
Right. So like all of a sudden it's like, oh, wow, do we really have catching depth? You know, that's the thing. And so they signed Travis d'Arnaud. He was released by the Mets on Friday. They signed him Sunday, major league deal. So he's right on the team. And that gives them at the moment three catchers, but like the way they sort of maneuver guys, like I think it's just more likely that even if he doesn't catch a ton, like he's just another right-handed bat. Like he's been decent throughout his career against lefties, not nothing great shakes, but you know, if you compare him to like catcher or maybe even like a regular pinch hitter, he's you know, pretty decent. So we'll see how they use him. I don't think he's going to necessarily compete for a bunch of playing time with Martin and Barnes, but maybe just another right-handed bat off the bench. He's a local guy. Went to Lakewood High School, just right out in Long Beach, I guess, or just outside of Long Beach. He had Tommy John surgery last April, so he barely played. And then this year he got off to sort of a bad start. He was just 2 for 23, didn't really play much. And he, like I said, was released by the Mets. He was interesting. Like, he was like a top pretty good top prospect for like a number of years. I think he was on the Baseball America list, like a top 100, like 5 years in a row, you know, and he peaked, like he was like a consensus top 25 guy in 2012 and 2013. So huge prospect. He was part of the trade from the Phillies to the Blue Jays for Roy Halladay. And then a few years later, the Blue Jays traded him with Noah Syndergaard to the Mets for R.A. Dickey. And at the time, if I remember right, D'Arnaud was the headliner of that deal, not Noah Syndergaard. So very interesting sort of minor league deals for him. And then he's just sort of worked his way up. He played a lot with the Mets. He's 30. He does have an option remaining, but it's for functional purposes. He really doesn't, because he has over 5 years of service time. So he could refuse any sort of minor league assignment. So for all intents and purposes, he's on the major league roster until, you know, they want to, you know, DFA him or something. But for now, another right-handed bat off the bench, and that's probably how they're going to use him. There's a couple other interesting things about him. Bob Guerin, Dodgers bench coach, was with the Mets for a while. He officiated his wedding. They showed some pictures of that on Sunday on the Dodgers broadcast. That was pretty funny. And I got to thinking about this, like, Oral Hershiser a couple years ago officiated Justin Turner's wedding. And I was thinking,
We need a stat, like percentage of major league players married by other major league coaches and players.
I guess, you know, I always like assumed it was like a priest or like some sort of, you have to, there's certainly like a license involved or whatever, but I don't think it's that stringent. You don't have to, you have to have like schooling or something for it. But I guess I wasn't aware of how many like civilians, as it were, like could marry people. And like, so I just thought, like, man, I wonder how many other baseball people marry baseball people. So that's like, that was in my head. I was thinking that, but I don't know.
It makes sense, though. You're on the road so often, you know, half the year you're kind of really, really in doing the grind. So it makes sense that so many of your close relationships are just going to be inside baseball.
Yeah, and the other thing about D'Arnaud that I sort of like, a couple years ago, the Mets were playing the Yankees. This was 2017. And I don't remember the exact injury situation the Mets had, but they were banged up, like, badly. And so they had D'Arnaud. I can't remember if he started at second or third base. I think he started at second. But they kept doing this shift, like, depending on who was batting, right or left, or, you know, depending on, like, other stuff. Excuse me. And they switched Asdrubal Cabrera and D'Arnaud back and forth, like, a lot. And if you go to this game, I think I tweeted out a picture of his part of the box score from Baseball Reference. And it's like, you know, you see like a normal box score and it just shows a position. And sometimes it's like second base / shortstop or something. And it, like, if they played multiple positions for D'Arnaud and Asdrubal Cabrera in this game, it was like second base, third base, second base, third base, second base. I swear, I think they switched like 15 times, I want to say, or maybe 12 or something ridiculous. So it's like, it's one of those where it like completely stretches the text and it like, it messes up any sort of formatting if you had it, you know. A very weird game, but the funny part about that, he's never played second or third in any other game. So like, that was his only time at not catcher or DH. So what an odd quirky game that was.
So as you mentioned, probably really clearly, and now and then maybe catching duty, pinch hitting duty, right-hand bat off the bench. Is there any chance that they put Austin Barnes at second and Russell Martin to catch, knowing that they have a backup catcher sort of in an emergency situation?
Sure. Like that's, I think that's more likely in terms of getting creative with those three guys. I know we've seen Martin play like third and stuff. And I know last year he finally played short and I think he played left for the first time. So like, I'm sure he's itching to get at other positions, but of all the those three catchers who the Dodgers are like willing to move around, I think it's more likely you'll see Barnes at second and they use like Kike in the outfield as they sort of have been on occasion with, especially with Pollock out.
The way things have been going, are they going to need elite closer Russell Martin even more?
Well, that's true. Like, yeah, he, I mean, still tied for the league lead with a zero ERA. And he, like, well, the records show that he was the first, is this right? I guess it wasn't. I mean, he wasn't the first Dodger reliever to close out a win, but he closed out a Dodger win before Kenley Jansen this year. So good on Martin.
And we're going to talk about Kenley, but real quick, I want you to mention who else Russell Martin is tied with on the ERA league-leading ERA list.
Well, first of all, you name your comp first, because I know he's tied with someone that you mentioned when we weren't recording.
Old friend Charlie Culberson.
Yep, old Mr. Walk-off in Vin Scully's final home game, Charlie Culberson. Yeah, zero ERA. Also with a zero ERA, Dylan Floro.
A few more real reliever. Pitched.
Yeah, 15 innings. He's tied with Ryan Pressly of the Astros for most innings with his, of all the zero ERA so far this year. He's been pretty excellent since the Dodgers acquired him last year. And, yeah, he sort of continues to do that. He gave up last week. He had a he did give up a three-run double. All three runs were inherited, so they weren't his. One of those, like, but like overall, like he's been fine. Like, I think outside of that, I think it was like he stranded like 8 of 9 inherited runners on the season. So, and batters are hitting almost nothing against him. So, overall, he's been excellent. So good for him.
Let's talk about less than excellent bullpen. I don't want to say bad exactly, but. Do we want to talk about Joe Kelly, or is he just basically doing more of the same? Does he look at all better to you before we talk about Kenley?
No. So I have to confess, on Saturday, I went back and only saw after the fact on Saturday. I was at Podcastathon, the Never Not Funny pod, like sort of annual telethon. It's a podcast with Jimmy Pardo and Matt Belknap, and it's like 12 to 13 hours of comedy. They have like a bunch of guests and it's a long, long day of comedy. And for the most part, pretty captive audience in there. I had my phone, but I was like only barely checking it during the game. So I wasn't really following along, but I did see a few texts from my brothers suggesting things they would want to do to Joe Kelly, et cetera. Joe Kelly just updated the numbers. 13 and a third innings pitched, 23 hits, 15 runs. Not so good. 10-13 ERA. He's pitched 13 games. 8 of those games, someone has scored off him, so it's not the best. The game Saturday, so he entered with a 3-run lead, I guess, in the 6th, and then he faced 5 batters. He recorded 1 out, and then. Pretty soon it was no longer a Dodger lead. It was tied. And then the Dodgers did end up winning that game, but it was a roller coaster, thanks to another sort of bad, bad Joe Kelly outing so far.
Yeah. He had an outing against the Giants where not only were the results much better, but he looked better. The fastball just appeared to have a little bit more bite to it, but that certainly could just have been an effect of playing against the Giants. So.
Yeah. And I think too, like, it was when I was thinking like as he sort of still struggles and then like they have like Urias and Stripling now in the bullpen, maybe Joe Kelly would be faced like lower leverage situation than he kind of has, or they just have avoided using him. But that game Saturday, like it was a high leverage situation where he was pitching. So sometimes you just can't avoid it, you know, whoever's available. Maybe some people aren't available that day or whatever, but it was not the best.
All right. We've been delaying it long enough. Let's talk about Kenley.
Yep. it's more of the same, I think, from last year. Like Kenley Jansen, for the most part, didn't really give up a ton of home runs in his career. He did like occasionally, but you know, last year it was kind of, he kind of allowed them at like double the rate he was normally allowing them. And then it's sort of been the same this year. I think, what was it last year, he gave up a home run every like 22 plate appearances. This year it's one every 18. He's given up 4 home runs, 72 batter space. So, he's looked better, you know, like than he did the start of last year, but then the home runs continue to be a problem. And that's sort of the glaring, like, fly on the wall. I was looking at like his Statcast numbers. It's hard to say, like his numbers are still like really good, although the slugging is way up because of the home runs, and like his expected numbers are still like pretty good, but not like not great, like not like elite reliever great. Still striking out a bunch of batters, but not like he was at his peak, but that's also fine. He's like his K rate, he struck out a third of the batters. That Statcast says that's top 8% of the league, so that's good. I was looking at this, like his barrel percentage this year is like 11%, so of all batted balls, like his normal career rate is 6.7%, so that's way up. Like 2016, 2017, when he was kind of at his peak, it was 5.2%, 4.3%, so he's been getting hit harder more often. But also still relatively effective, although the sort of coup de grace on this was Sunday, Dodgers were going for the sweep in San Diego. They were down 4-0, came back to lead 5-4, and it got into the ninth. And then I think it was, if I remember right, traditional single and then two like bunt singles, the first of which especially should have been fielded, I think. It was like a confusion between, or I guess the second one, I'm sorry, between Justin Turner and Kenley Jansen. So single, then two bunt singles, bases are loaded with nobody out. And then Kenley got strikeout, pop out, and then it looked like, you know, hey, he could probably get out of this. Dodgers are nursing a one-run lead. And I think on the second pitch to Hunter Renfroe, yeah, he just absolutely crushed the ball. And grand slam, walk-off, Padres win. So the one like sort of funny thing about this, I guess, is I was looking through the, I think it was Getty Images for the game, and there's like a couple shots, and I didn't see this on the video, but being a grand slam, you know, Kenley's like, it's a walk-off win, the term teams walking off the field. So the pitcher's mound to the dugout, Dodgers dugout's on the third base side. He's walking off, like, I forgot who was on third, maybe it was no, I don't remember who it was, but he was on Cosmer, a collision course. What? Yeah, that's, I think that's right. And he was on a collision course with Kenley, and they sort of had to avoid each other. So it's like super awkward. Like, hey, I'm celebrating because we won. Oh, sorry, guy. You know, like, but it was just kind of this awkward like maneuver. But yeah, so that's it's an issue. You just have to watch. You know, hope that it can. Improve, but yeah, it's not good.
So the Dodgers aren't big fans of big splashy free agent signings when they can avoid it. But what if they traded a lot of cash considerations to Craig Kimbrell for Craig Kimbrell? Is that possible? If they view it as a trade, do they think they'll do it?
I think so. I think yeah. But I guess is it just like, are they trading like his financial advisor, like who they send the cash to? Like,
I think so.
Yeah, that's a decent transaction. But yeah, like you could. But here's the deal about that. Like, as with like so many major league teams right now, like let's say Kenley was still Kenley and like Pete Kenley or whatever, the Dodgers should probably still sign Craig Kimbrell because like. But now it's like, okay, let's just shore this up a little even more. But yeah, so that's certainly an option. So as we sort of transitioned into Kenley, I meant to look this up before, but I just did now. So Joe Kelly, I mentioned that he's given up 23 hits and 15 runs. Robert Gsellman on the Mets has given up 23 runs and 23 hits, excuse me, in relief this year, tied with Kelly. Only old friend Jesse Chavez, 24 hits. and Matt Koch, sorry, audio, it's weird, but you know, K-O-C-H, he's allowed 29 hits in relief, although he's been more of a long reliever, it looks like, 20 and two thirds innings compared to just 13 and a third for Joe Kelly. So, those are the only two who's given up more hits than him. Koch has given up 21 runs. He's the only one who's given up more runs in relief than Joe Kelly. Mike Wright and Jesse Chavez have also given up 15 runs. So he has been among the worst relievers in baseball this year. So that's where the Dodgers sort of back into the bullpen's at right now.
Well, we've got a couple of questions from Twitter, but before we get to that, I have a question for you.
Yep.
Based on our show notes, why do you like the quality start?
Oh, yeah. So this came up. It was just one of those random things. Like, I'm watching a game and something interesting, I'll tweet it out. Oh, or some obscure stat or something. But I've always sort of liked the quality start. It's very crude. It's not advanced, certainly. But it's like a just a sort of nice little thumbnail, rudimentary sort of, like literal like depiction of quality, and I agree with it. So the term is, or the definition is, minimum of six innings pitched and no more than three earned runs. You can get us into some sticky situations where I think Rich Hill had this game earlier this year where I believe he allowed five runs, but only one of them was earned. So, and he did, I think he pitched six innings, so it was a quality start, but you look at that, you're like, is it really a quality start? But yeah, so there's obviously hairy issues, but I tweeted out during Clayton Kershaw's start, because he started four times, and all four times he's pitched a quality start. The starting question on, I guess this was Friday, was the bare minimum, the six innings, three earned runs. He had the sort of Randy Wolfian start where he allowed three runs relatively early. I believe Machado hit him for a two-run home run in the first. He gave up a solo shot a little later. But then he still managed to get through six innings, so sort of gutted it out. And I got a lot of pushback on Twitter from this, like, oh, 4.5 ERA, quality, really? Like, oh, this is disgusting. Like, people are, like, angry. And I don't get that, right? Like, that's what I sort of balk at usually is the backlash. But I just wanted to point out, because everyone always focuses on the bare minimum, which I think is the wrong thing to do here. But just from a conceptual level, I'll say this. In sort of modern baseball, I think having someone go at least six innings, almost no matter what they give up. Like, look, sure, someone gives up like seven runs in six innings is not a good start. But just sometimes you got to get someone to eat innings, because we've seen bullpens get taxed all the time. That in itself has value. It's good. And then if you can get someone who doesn't give up more than three earned runs, sure, there's unearned runs a lot. But on a general level, super basic, that is giving a team a chance to win the game. And I think that is indicative of quality, even at the bare minimum level. That said, if it's all, you know, it's certainly not all bare minimum. So I did some research. So since the start of last year, so a full season plus about, you know, a fifth of a season right now, there's quality starts in like 40% of all games. And 40% of all team games. So like every game is like two games. So the Dodgers and Padres played yesterday. They had two chances at a quality start. When teams have a quality start, their winning percentage is .686. That is ridiculously good. Like, they win over two thirds of their games. And just to put this in another way, if you look at every other game that didn't have a quality start, teams have a .446 winning percentage. So I just, on a base level, that should tell you that getting a quality start vastly improves your chances of winning. But also, so people focus on the bare minimum. But overall, the cumulative ERA of all the quality starts, and there have been 2,374 of them since the beginning of last season through Sunday. What would you guess is the ERA? I'll pose it to you. What would you guess is the ERA for all the quality starts combined?
2.8.
It's 1.79.
Wow.
These are dominant games. Like, it includes every, like, great game, right? Like, and the when pitchers, like, last longer, they tend to pitch better, and they're lasting longer for a reason, and that sort of skews it. Like, but also, the people focus on the minimum. That only accounts for 9% of the games. So there's, like, a ton of games that are way better than the minimum requirement, and those are increase your chances of winning even more. So that's sort of where it comes in. And then also the average quality start over that period is 6.6 innings, which is, you know, just very, very a sliver shy of 6 2/3. The average innings pitched this year in Major League Baseball for starters is 5.31. Last year was 5.36. So you can see it's like these advantages right away. So, like I said, it's not the be-all, end-all of stats. I like it as a sort of a quick and dirty, hey, if someone gives you a quality start, they give you a chance to win. That's what I like about it. It's not the best stat, but it's not crap either. And that's sort of my defense of it.
Couple Twitter questions for you. Us, I think I can answer some of these, maybe.
Absolutely.
From my favorite Twitter handle, True for Dingers.
Yep.
How do you feel about the post-Matt Beaty era? I already miss tweeting Bat Meaty when he gets a base hit.
So, transactionally, when AJ Pollock hit the DL, Matt Beaty was who they called up.
Gotta train you.
Exactly right. So when he went on the injured list, they brought up Matt Beaty and from AAA, and then when they signed Travis d'Arnaud on Sunday, they sent Matt Beaty down. So in between. He pinch hit 3 times. He didn't play the field. He was 2 for 3. He had a single in his first game, and then he had an RBI single on, I believe, Saturday. So good for him, 2 for 3. Already, he has the most hits of any player in Belmont history in the majors. Like, there's only been 3 other players from Belmont University. It's in Tennessee. And both were pitchers in the 70s, Jerry Bell and Dwight Bernard. But as hitters, Jerry Bell was 1 for 14. Dwight Bernard was 1 for 5. Matt Beaty, in his 3 at-bats, matched the totality of Belmont offense with his 2 singles. So, and he's the first Belmont player to drive in a run in the majors. So good for Matt Beaty. Plays the corners. I think he has been mixing in outfield, if I'm not mistaken. So one of those guys, they can, if they want as an extra bat occasionally, they could bring him up. And then he's also a left-handed hitter, and both of his hits were against lefties. So nice little week for him. It was cool.
And Scott Lewis wants our guess on when Joe Kelly hits the IL on a mystery injury.
Oh, yeah. So this... I guess I should have saved the Joe Kelly chunk for this, because this is what I sort of had it. But you know, this is always the thing, like, players going bad, it's like, aha, he's going to have plantar fasciitis, you know, or whatever. And then they put him on the IL. But who knows? I don't know if that's going to happen or when. It might, certainly. But, I still think ultimately they want him to sort of, if there's something like mechanically, maybe I could see it. Like, if they're like, let's work on this for a little bit. So let's shut you down, put you on the DL. But I don't know. I don't see it yet. But then again, I don't know what he's necessarily dealing with. By all accounts, he seems physically fine. But yeah, we'll see.
The Dodgers' tolerance for players like this, it seems like it's pretty good into the summer. Before, you know, especially if the team is winning, where they're willing to give time to these guys kind of figure themselves out. So I could still see something happening, but I would guess closer to the All-Star break of continued results like this, right? Where they're not using him in any high leverage situations, really. He found himself into a sort of medium leverage situation in San Diego, I know, but he's still only pitching every few days. So I see them keeping that up for at least another month before they try anything else. Again, barring an actual injury. And I don't think it needs, I will say this. I don't think it has to be a an injury that maybe someone else might play through, that they might use as an excuse of, okay, let's get you really healthy and then work on it. But in terms of actually inventing one, I think he's got another month or so of rope.
I think so too. So I don't, they've kind of shown that they could like put him on, like not use him necessarily all the time. So use him sparingly. And I think as long as they have the sort of freedom roster wise to do that, I don't think they're going to force anything just yet.
So time to wind things down. You don't have a Dodgers rewind for us. I've got some questions from Craig, but you gave me a heads up when I turned the mics off a little bit. You're about to ambush me with something. I hope it's good.
I just wanted to mention one thing before we go into question of Craig. Justin Turner did get off the schneid last week, and he hit his first home run of the season, and it was before May. I think it was on the last day of April. So, like I said, he was hitting, like his batted ball numbers looked better than his actual numbers, so maybe he'll start to heat up now. But yeah, so he no longer has zero home runs, but he does have one. And, you know, the journey of a thousand steps starts, or 1,000 miles starts with a single step, or whatever that phrase is. So he's off the schneid. That's all I wanted to say.
Okay, questions from Craig. You ready?
Yeah.
Okay, so the first is a trivia question for you. So I have all the answers. And I was actually thinking, if you had a Dodgers rewind, one of the answers to these two questions, it's a two-parter, would have been someone you did. So maybe next week, maybe you'll pick
nice.
one of these
okay.
guys. The first question, with the acquisition of Travis d'Arnaud, the Dodgers will likely have at least four catchers who play defense for them in 2019. When was the last time the Dodgers had five catchers who caught in at least one game in a season? And can you name the catchers?
Oh, my God. Okay.
I'm not going to lay you... I'll give you hints as you go along, because otherwise we're just doing a bunch of guesses. But
okay, so I was thinking... So 2016 was the year that they had... when they traded AJ Ellis for Chooch, and they already had Grindahl, and Barnes was up and down. So that's already four.
Mm-hmm.
And they did call up Sean Zuraga for that one day in between the trade, but he never played. And I can't think of anyone else who would have caught that year.
It is before 2016.
Mm-hmm. So on the, oh man.
You have said one of the catchers though. I'll give you that hint.
Okay. So let's assume then, is it the Miguel Olivo year?
Is
he one of the five?
Not.
Okay. Okay, I'm assuming AJ Ellis is the one.
You are correct.
Okay. Okay, so at one of his earlier years, maybe when they still had Brad Ausmus.
Nope.
So maybe when they didn't. Maybe, was it a Hector Jimenez year?
It was.
I believe that was 2010?
2011.
It was 11, okay. So I have to name him. Okay. Okay, 12 was AJ Ellis' breakout year. And I believe the year before, the Dodge, he had the infamous, like, you're sending down the wrong guy speech with Don Mattingly when he got sent down. And then he sort of proved himself. But I believe so, Rod Barajas.
That one. So you've got three now. You're missing two.
Okay, AJ Ellis, Rod Barajas. Man, this is harder than I thought it was going to be. who would have been the Russell Martin's already gone. Man, this is difficult.
One of the names very.
Okay. So they is this when they got Deonor Navarro back?
Yep.
Okay, so that's four. And honestly, I don't know who the fifth would be.
If you had to ship me a baseball, what wonderful service would you use? I'm acting like they're a sponsor. That's weird. Would you use UPS?
I would probably use UPS. Oh, FedEx. That's it. Yeah.
I'm like, swinging
on
this.
I just said UPS.
I tried.
Trying to talk myself into it. Like, I was like, surely I'll understand what he's talking about when I say it. But then, actually, it was funny. The second one that came to mind was DHL. And I'm like, whose initials are DHL? Nice. Okay.
So, yeah, Tim Fedorovics. The second question. Only once in LA Dodger franchise history have six players caught in a season. That season was 1976. How many can you name?
Okay, so right away, you just have to start off with Steve Yeager and Joe Ferguson.
Yep.
Man, Johnny Oates?
Nope.
Okay.
Craig mentions that two others you might know, and the other two you're not going to guess.
Okay. 76. I don't remember. Yeah. I'm just trying to think here.
I'll give you five more seconds.
Okay. John Hale was not a catcher, I don't think, was he? Mm-mm,
nope.
Okay. So, yeah, I'm stumped on this. I don't know.
Ellie Rodriguez?
Of course, yeah.
Ted Sizemore? Yeah. And then the two he doesn't think you'll know are Kevin Paisley and Sergio Robles.
I wouldn't have guessed those two for sure. I had baseball cards of the other two. But, yeah, I didn't place the year. So, that was a good one.
Yeah, I liked it. Question the second. I had a calzone last night for dinner, which leads me to this question. Are you two fans of pastry-wrapped savory pies, turnovers, empanadas? And if so, what is your favorite?
I can't say I have them enough.
They're not super common here. When I went to Europe for the first time, I was in England, and they are everywhere there, and they are delicious.
Yeah, I think especially if you have like I'm assuming like a puff pastry type crust is probably the best way to go for that, mm-hmm. or maybe, and it's not as thick, but it's crumbly and good. I bet that would be amazing. But yeah, I can't say I've had it enough to really have a preference or anything. I will say, I just wanted to mention too, we're doing questions from Craig. I was sitting next to Craig at the aforementioned podcast-a-thon on Saturday. Also with us was fellow True Blue LA commenter FBI Hop, who flew in from Albuquerque to see it. So we had a fun time. That was a good show. Craig did not have an empanada as far as I'm, or what did he say, calzone? Yeah, I think he had a pizza when I was sitting next to him. So he had back-to-back nights of that. That's good for him.
Real quick, shout out to any listeners in Portland. Don't know if we have any, but if so, it's closed now, but they had a food cart called Withy's, which made fried pies, both sweet and savory. And I think that was probably the first time I ever had one. And they made them right in front of you. And that is my favorite, not close. I hope somehow that cart comes back.
They just opened up Porto's Bakery, like literally right down the street from me. Oh. And I've never been there.
You've never been to a Porto's?
I have never been.
You're from Los Angeles. the greater LA area. You are
not really from Los Angeles.
No. I know. That's still shocking to me.
So at some point, I'm going to have to make my way down there. I think that's going to be my best bet in getting one of these delicious concoctions. So.
I don't know if they have them. They must. I always just get
I will make them have them.
you could probably make your own. Third question. Continuing from last week. Saw a note that Scrabble added 2,800 new words, including okay. Craig just wants to know if we're a fan of these sort of word games. Scrabble, Boggles, Word with Friends. Wait,
did he say they add the two-letter okay?
They did.
That's ridiculous. I am. I like those games. I haven't played Words with Friends for a long time, which is essentially a Scrabble knockoff, but it's because it's an app on your phone and it's fun. It was a fun game to play, but I haven't played in a while. But yeah, I do like those. It's sort of a distraction, brain puzzle type of a game. I enjoy it. I can't say I play enough to be good at. I think I like Boggle quite a bit, but like I said, I just haven't played it enough recently. But yeah, I used to play Boggle, and then they have the Super Boggle, which is just a larger grid. Those are always fun. I remember. My brother's wife is a teacher, and a couple times they're in Baltimore, so don't see them as often as I'd like. But a few times we've had family get-togethers, and we ended up playing Boggle or something. And Lisa, my brother's wife's name, she would like dominate those sessions of Boggle. I was like, okay, remind me never to play Boggle. Or no, it's fun. So she's very good at it.
I subscribe to and this is sort of a recent. I do a lot of bar trivia, which I've talked about before. Mm-hmm. But try and improve that in my general puzzle trivia knowledge. I've started doing the New York Times crossword.
Oh.
I'm not sure if you were aware of this, but it gets progressively harder throughout the week. And then Sunday is roughly the same as a Thursday, but it's a lot bigger. That's the Sunday puzzle. And so I can pretty easily and quickly do Mondays and Tuesdays, and most of the time Wednesdays. But even on Thursdays, I'm getting stuck, whereas I have friends who do Saturdays in 15 minutes, and I have no idea. A lot of it is practice, where you just learn a lot of 3- and 4-letter words that come up a lot. So once you get those down, it unlocks a lot of the rest. But I also think they're probably just a lot smarter than me. So one day.
So I have the New York Times crossword app on my phone. I didn't pay. I don't do the pay subscription service. So I just do the little free mini ones, which are very small. But it's more, like I said, it's just more of a brain exercise thing for me. There's another crossword app that I use. I forgot the name of it, but a little bit longer. And I do like to do that from time to time. I'll dabble in Sudoku. These are just things on my phone I could grab and like play as I'm waiting for something. So I do like those type of sort of distraction-y type games. Also, I know the New York Times reached out and had like some celebrity people write crosswords. Like they do that occasionally. And I remember Weird Al had a crossword last year in the New York Times. And I believe there were a lot of puns in it. And I enjoyed that. I enjoyed that quite a bit.
One Across is the other big crossword app that I'm aware of. So that might be it. Mm-hmm. And the great thing about it, and this was, I think, literally the first month or two of the App Store existing. But for a long while, that One Across would also have access to the Onion's crossword. And the Onion doesn't do a crossword anymore. But the Onion's crossword was probably as hard as maybe a Wednesday New York Times. And was basically R-rated, irreverent, really, really good. A lot of fun. A lot of one or two swear words would be found in the crossword, you know, per week. So I do miss doing that.
One might as well earn the explicit tag this week. I just want, it's still one of the, my favorite all-time Onion headline is the old, when they had the books of the old fake newspaper Onions from like, and then it was just war, but the font was so big that it was WA-. And then the R was on the next page. the other headline that cracks me up all the time on the Onion is, holy fucking shit, we landed on the moon.
Yeah.
So they're good. I love it.
Fourth question. Three NL teams, the Cubs, the Diamondbacks, and the Dodgers, currently have an 800 OPS or greater as a team. Mm-hmm. Only 17 National League teams after 1956, all between 1995 and 2007, have had an 800 or greater OPS. Can this Dodger team accomplish this feat too?
I mean, yeah, so right now they're like right on the cusp, right? They're 801. Their OPS plus is 114. I think they could be at that level, like roughly for the whole season. So I think they could do it. They're probably going to fall a little bit short, but I think they're good enough to actually pull that off.
If Chris Taylor and Max Muncy's sort of mini resurgences this week hold, or you know, hold in some degree to where they're not the players that, and this is more true for Chris Taylor. Muncy had a fine, if not spectacular, April.
Right.
But if they can be something closer to the players they were last year, I feel much more confident that could kind of buoy any sort of regression from, say, Cody Bellinger.
Right.
And if that's the case, I certainly think they could. I don't know if I would bet that they will, but I think that it's certainly possible.
Yeah, Taylor had a nice Muncy too, but they both had nice weekends in San Diego. Taylor had the go-ahead home run on Sunday that had the Dodgers in the lead before they sort of blew to the ninth. But they faced five lefties last week, so Taylor played a ton. Like you said, with Pollock out, it frees them up to do some things now. So if he's going to get more playing time, yeah, he needs to hit. But also, just looking at this too, we're still at a point where, like, just I'm just reading OPS here only. Corey Seager's at 686. Justin Turner's at 707. They're the worst Dodgers regulars. So unless you count Chris Taylor as a regular, who's below them. But so that also needs to improve as well. So, so that's another reason to sort of think that they could probably pull this off just the depth they have.
All right. The last question before we sign off. On June 1st, which team, either the Rays or the Twins, are more likely to lead their division? Craig thinks it's the Twins.
Yeah, my default gut answer is the Twins, only because I was so put off by the Indians offseason that they were like, we're clearly the best in the division. They were trying to dump a pitcher, clearly like in dumping salary mode and trading some guys. So I think just for spite reasons, I don't want them to win. But look, the Rays have the Yankees and the Red Sox. The Red Sox are still a game under 500. But the Yankees are – and the Yankees, they're like literally everybody hurt. But they're like two games back of the Rays right now. The Rays are 21-12. The Twins are 20-12. Those are the two best records in the American League. Actually, in baseball right now. But just given the competition, it's hard to say that Rays can keep this up. They could play better than the Twins between now and June, and then the Yankees could still pass them. So I think that's why I would say the Twins are most likely to still be in front. I'll stick with the Twins.
No, and I agree. That said, I would not be surprised if the Rays do end up on top, just given their year, given the Red Sox struggles, and given the Yankees injuries. So,
sure. And like for the whole season, like look, they won 90 games last year. And if they could sort of keep this up, they could potentially make the playoffs, even in a sort of loaded American League. I would definitely not put it past them.
But both of them are good to see. When you and I were kind of looking at the divisions going into the year, there were a lot of divisions that just weren't hard to see anything but a clear favorite or maybe two, and certainly not a ton of potential for surprise teams. So it's been a fun year so far.
Right. And then I guess the National League East is probably the most competitive, at least on paper, it looked like, because you have basically everybody but the Marlins like sort of competing. As it stands, they're all sort of they're kind of a little bit bunched together. The Phillies are in front right now. The Nationals like continue to sort of underwhelm. They're actually 14-19. But the Dodgers play the Braves and the Nationals this week. They're back to out of division play. They play the NL East at home. So that'll be an interesting week. The Braves, who they played in the NLDS last year, coming to town, Ronald Acuña Jr. et al. So it should be an exciting week.
Well, I think that's all we have. You and nothing really going on in your and I's life. We're boring. So we'll be here next week.
Right. And I will not have a comedy podcast to go to next weekend. So I will be much fresher next week. But no, thanks for listening, everybody. I think we're going to send out a call for some questions next week. Maybe we could do like a more of a mailbag episode. Although, as we say, there's like probably like three things will happen that'll be like,
clearly. If we have a sort of a more normal mid-season day. Maybe we'll even get the main account to tweet it out, get a lot more questions in that way.
Sure thing. But thanks for listening, everybody. And we'll talk to you next week.